From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. This year's election will have a major impact on the U.S. Supreme Court. An expert from the Cato Institute will join us to explain why the next president will have a chance to reshape the court's direction. The state auditor's office focuses on specific programs and agencies, but many of the same problems crop up again and again in audits across state government. You'll learn the details. The UNC system is looking into performance-based funding to help ensure the university delivers bang for the buck. A national expert offers some ideas. Plus, we'll have updates on two recent Carolina Journal stories involving government restrictions of private property rights. Those stories are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
North Carolina can set the stage for economic prosperity by pursuing policies that promote and enhance individual liberty. That is the driving theme behind more than 85 recommendations on everything from taxes, spending, education, health care, to regulation, property rights, and a lot more. All of this detailed in the 20th anniversary edition of the John Locke Foundation's Agenda. Dr. Roy Cordato and his research team have authored the new Agenda report. He joins us now to talk about it. Roy, welcome back to the program.
Glad to be back, Donna.
Why produce the Agenda report?
Well, from the beginning, it comes out every 2 years during the election season for it's the year where we have all the legislature is up for election, and every 4 years the governor. So it really focuses on North Carolina state issues. Although it's much broader than this, it's at least in part a sort of a policy guide for candidates, and we hope when those candidates eventually take office will be a policy guide in terms of how to govern the state. So that's the primary focus. Say, here's what John Locke Foundation thinks should be going on in North Carolina public policy.
If someone were to actually look at Agenda, and by the way, it is available at johnlocke.org. You can download a PDF of the document or read it online, whichever you prefer. It's primarily for candidates in the election cycle, but Roy, everything in here is really important to anyone who wants to believe in and help promote freedom.
Yeah, if you're trying to figure out, you know, well, how can or how does a free market person, for example, a person who believes in individual liberty, limited government, how would a person who has those views tackle whatever the issue? I mean, you mentioned several of them, for anywhere from regulation to property rights, taxes, economic growth. We cover everything in this booklet. This is the place to go. I mean, it is, I think, a very complete guide, particularly with respect to economic issues. Now, as is typical of John Locke Foundation, we do not cover social issues in the book, but it's what we do as an organization.
The guiding principles then being keep government limited to mm-hmm. core services.
Keep government limited to core services and have them do those efficiently. And promote, by really staying out of the way, entrepreneurship, investment, economic growth, a sound education system, a sound healthcare system, by essentially leaving decisions to consumers and producers.
Now, over the past several years, both in the legislature and from the governor, we've seen some progress in some of these
mm-hmm.
areas.
Oh, yeah, a major progress. Things I was writing about, three or four agendas ago, Much of it has come to fruition in terms of tax policy, for example, with the tax reform of 2013 and then later on subsequent reductions in taxes, corporate taxes. We have seen the agenda, I think, have a significant influence on public policymakers. There are areas where we need to do things, right? Healthcare, I think, is a big one. We've, for many years, going as far back as I can remember, the agenda has been calling for elimination of certificate of need laws, which dramatically control who can enter the healthcare market, who can enter the hospital market, you know, who can buy, get, and provide MRI services. We think they should be eliminated. Well, we still think they should be eliminated.
And on that score, Roy, our listeners may not realize that the government, state government, plays a major role in deciding, what services are, quote, needed. And essentially that's a permission slip to get.
That's exactly what it is. They decide, rather than market participants, decide what services are needed, where they're needed, how they should be provided. That is all very centrally controlled by the state government. So it's kind of the antithesis of what John Locke believes in and promotes in all other areas. If you take something like certificate of need and just think of it the exact opposite of what they're doing and apply that to every single area that we talk about, it'll probably get you to the right place.
Now, Roy, as you and I are talking about the new agenda document, again, it's available at johnlocke.org. The state is now reeling from Hurricane Matthew and dealing with recovery efforts and restoration efforts. One of the issues that has come up has been the fact that the state now has a pretty robust rainy day fund, reserve money to tap for things like recovery efforts with Matthew. And that, interestingly, relates to some of the ideas and principles that are in the agenda document when it comes to being good fiscal stewards for the state.
Absolutely. And that's something we have been pushing for quite a while. We have, you know, on the one hand, we've promoted tax cuts and in the name of economic growth. And that has happened. We have seen very robust, especially relative to the rest of the country, economic growth over the last 3 years in North Carolina. With that growth, we have generated some budget surpluses. And while we've given some of those budget surpluses, not we, the legislature has given some of those budget surpluses back to the taxpayer, which we do think is a way to go. It's also said, look, there's going to be recessions. There's going to be problems. There's going to be hurricanes. We need to have a strong a rainy day fund, a savings account to draw on when there's problems. And we've been beefing that up significantly.
Now, also in agenda, you are recommending some other things that could be done that would really help to spur more tax reform, more economic growth. What are those?
On the tax side, something that we've talked about, especially recently, as the tax reform of 2013 has come into place, we start to look ahead. What more can be done? We don't have the perfect tax system; we have a very good one. But we are arguing that we should be either reducing or eliminating the tax on capital gains. For example, we should be changing the way we treat investments in capital equipment, allowing companies to write those investments off immediately rather than, say, over a 5 or 10 or 20 year period in some cases. those are a couple things. On the regulatory side, we think there's ways to go on really reducing red tape in the state, which is an important issue. We've done a lot of that. But again, we think that's a direction we can continue to move in. We're always looking at education reform. Terry Stoops has a number of chapters. I think a third of the agenda is devoted to education. But if you think about it, a very large proportion of our state budget is also devoted. So it's proportional. And again, there we can go further with tuition scholarships, promoting education choice in the state. So there's a number of issues where we think there's room to do better, but we also think that we have come a long way.
And it's all available for you in the new agenda document produced by the research team led by Dr. Roy Cordato here at the John Locke Foundation. And it is posted at johnlocke.org. We've been talking with Dr. Roy Cordato. Roy, thanks very much.
Sure.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment. Are you wondering where our country is headed? Well, so are two of our most revered presidents. Spend an evening with Thomas Jefferson and John Adams. That's right, Jefferson and Adams visit the Museum of History in Raleigh for a debate on the future of the United States. Hear what Jefferson and Adams think about national security, foreign engagement, and the role of government. While time has passed since they led our country, you'd be amazed the issues and challenges endure. It's a living history event starring two incredible actors as Jefferson and Adams. Monday evening, October 24th, brought to you by the John Locke Foundation. Find details at johnlocke.org. That's John Locke with an E.org. Or call 866-JLF-INFO. Monday evening, October 24th, at the Museum of History in Raleigh. Tickets are $10 per person, $5 for students. Thomas Jefferson and John Adams live in Raleigh, October 24th. Hope to see you there.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Elections have consequences, and the 2016 election will have plenty of them. Our next guest has been spending time looking at potential legal and judicial implications of the 2016 election. Doug Bondo is senior fellow at the Cato Institute. Thanks for joining us.
Happy to be on.
So obviously, for many reasons, the 2016 election is going to be very important. You've been focusing on sort of the legal and judicial impacts that could come about because of 2016. What have you been focusing on particularly?
Well, this is a major election for the Supreme Court. There's not only the Scalia vacancy because the Republicans refused to confirm, the President Obama's nominee, Merrick Garland. So that one remains vacant. But also we have three justices who are at 78 or older. And 78 has been the average retirement age. So we're looking at the potential of Justice Ginsburg, of Justice Breyer, and Justice Kennedy. All are at the age where one could imagine them retiring. You could see the next president have four Supreme Court nominations. Well, that's almost half the court. That would be extraordinary.
And some people listening who don't follow the court very closely might say, well, so what? Big deal. What happens when you have so many new faces on the court?
Well, it will be transformational in terms of the philosophy of the court. The reality is, while the court talks about the Constitution and in theory these justices are not, guided by political views, the reality is we have folks there who range from left to right in terms of how they view the Constitution, the kind of rulings they would engage in. And if you include Scalia, we're talking about there's a major conservative, Scalia, someone who's kind of center-right, Kennedy, and two folks on the left, Ginsburg and Breyer. I mean, you have an opportunity then to shift the court pretty dramatically. Right now, it's kind of a 5-4, sort of thing. Kennedy shifts back and forth. Well, if you shift that by a couple of votes, suddenly you have a solid majority one way or the other. It's a big different change in the court.
Well, the two candidates who are battling it out to win the presidential race, the ones who will make this appointment, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, do we have much of a sense of what types of justices they would appoint?
Well, we don't know for certain, obviously. I mean, Hillary Clinton has supported Merrick Garland, the nominee of President Obama. In fact, he worked in the Clinton Justice Department. She might resubmit him, I suppose, if she was elected president. There's no reason to think that she's uncomfortable with the kind of justices that both her husband and Barack Obama nominated. My guess is that she would be fairly liberal in the people that she chose. The people chosen by President Obama, Elaine Kagan, Sonia Sotomayor, both are on the left of the court. They've moved the court in a more left-wing direction. I would assume that Hillary Clinton would do the same. Donald Trump, it's a little harder to know. Now, Trump has actually given a list of 11 potential nominees. Now, these are people who are very well respected on the right. If, in fact, he followed through on that list, we'd be talking about the kind of appointments you would have expected out of a Bush or a Reagan that could move the appointment then, the court, to the right. We just don't know if he'd follow through. I think there are reasons to believe he would, but look, we don't know what Donald Trump would do. This is a unique candidate, a unique candidacy, a unique moment. Boy, making predictions there is pretty hard.
We are chatting with Doug Bondo, senior fellow at the Cato Institute. Once we see new faces on the court, what types of impact could they have on the way our government and our judicial process moves forward?
Well, there are a couple of things. It's not just the Supreme Court. There's also the appellate courts. Supreme Court hears about 80, you know, cases a year. There are 13 districts or 13 circuits, that is, of appellate. They have about 7,000 cases total a year. And in most instances, then, those opinions are final. I mean, reality. Now, you know, each circuit is technically final only for that particular circuit, but these are large chunks of America. So if what you find is at the top, these 80 cases, you know, a lot of those are fairly administrative or legal kinds of technical stuff, sometimes unanimous, but you're almost certainly going to get four, five, six big ones. I mean, it'll be abortion, it'll be health care, it'll be religious liberty, it'll be, you know, that sort of a thing. Those could be transformational in those areas of the law. And once the Supreme Court has set that ruling, then it trickles down to the circuits. Right now, 9 out of the 13 circuits are dominated by Democratic nominees. You know, at the end of another 4 years of a Democratic president, almost certainly all of those would be dominated by Democratic, you know, nominees. Now, if you have a Republican, you'd see a reversal of that, and some number of those would shift back and it'd be a much more balanced circuit. So I think that gives the sense. It's not just Supreme Court where those big cases get decided. It's the next level down where there's so many that almost all decisions that go there are final. It matters who's on those courts as well.
And if you have different philosophies approaching these cases, how does that lead to different types of rulings? Maybe pick a favorite subject area and tell us how they would rule differently.
Well, for example, the issue of, say, religious liberty. I mean, to what extent do you believe that people have a right to practice their religion, even if it means at some level? For example, I mean, the gay marriage issues come up. You know, I think the famous case, it's the baker who says, I don't want to bake a cake for a you know, same-sex marriage because I don't believe in the ceremony. I mean, what's important here, you know, this is not an issue of discrimination against somebody because they're gay. It's simply saying, I don't want to participate in something. To me, that's a fairly easy decision in terms of religious liberty. Whatever you think about same-sex marriage, the point is somebody shouldn't be groomed into having to support that. But that's one where you're very likely to find on the right and the left different opinions. What you find is people on the left tend to be more focused on what they perceive as discrimination. They don't like it, and they may not even grant that to somebody because of religious reasons. People on the right are much more likely to be focused on the importance of religious liberty, the importance of, you know, kind of strengthening the First Amendment. That's the kind of decision one could see decided differently. Healthcare under Obama, it's been decided, but there could be other cases that come up. You know, is there a constitutional justification for this legislation? Conservatives generally said no. Liberals said yes. Supreme Court, by a 5-4 margin with the Chief Justice, you know, the Republican nominee kind of shifting, said yes. Again, these are decisions. If these decisions came up with a very different membership, it could go the different way.
You are affiliated with the Libertarian Cato Institute. We know that one thing that libertarians have stressed about the courts is on the right side of the spectrum, the difference between those who are engaged, want an engaged judiciary, and ones who want to defer to the elected branches of government. Do we have a sense whether Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump have a preference one way or the other?
Well, I think Hillary Clinton clearly wants a more active kind of, you know, view. I mean, she certainly fits with traditional liberalism, which I think essentially courts are, judges are allies of those who want expansive government. That, you know, in the criminal law area, some of them may, you know, put some barriers, but for the most part, the view is government should be allowed to expand. So the irony is that in areas like, say, Fourth Amendment search and seizure, you know, the more liberal justice might say, no, here we don't want the police doing that, so they'd step in. In other areas like healthcare, they'd say, oh, the Congress has approved it, we shouldn't step in. You know, the challenge on the right is you do have a breakdown between people who talk about judicial restraint and people who try to take a different perspective. And I think that it's a very important difference. You know, the judicial restraint crowd focuses simply on whether the legislature, you know, is involved or not in allowing the legislature to do what it wants. I don't believe that's what the Constitution says. My view is restraint is simply a tool. It's a means to the end, which is vindicating the Constitution. So in some places, I think the Constitution is pretty clear. I mean, you know, the court shouldn't step in. It's a legislative decision. You allow it to go forward. But there are other places. Fourth Amendment is a very good one of protecting us from unlawful searches. The only way you protect that constitutional amendment, and it's part of the Bill of Rights, is for a court to step in at some point and say, no, you can't do that. The Constitution requires that we do something different. And there, I think, who knows what Donald Trump thinks? I mean, my sense is that he has no judicial philosophy. I think that he recognizes this is an important issue for conservatives and probably would choose justices that generally fit on the right.
One person who will be watching very closely as that moves forward is Doug Bondo, senior fellow at the Cato Institute. Thanks so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Happy to be here.
And we'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
Are you wondering where our country is headed? Well, so are two of our most revered presidents. Spend an evening with Thomas Jefferson and John Adams. That's right, Jefferson and Adams visit the Museum of History in Raleigh for a debate on the future of the United States. Hear what Jefferson and Adams think about national security, foreign engagement, and the role of government. While time has passed since they led our country, you'd be amazed the issues and challenges endure. It's a living history event starring two incredible actors as Jefferson and Adams. Monday evening, October 24th, brought to you by the John Locke Foundation. Find details at johnlocke.org. That's John Locke with an E, .org. Or call 866-JLF-INFO. Monday evening, October 24th, at the Museum of History in Raleigh. Tickets are $10 per person, $5 for students. Thomas Jefferson and John Adams live in Raleigh, October 24th. Hope to see you there.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today, buy something nice, and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. As the State Auditor's Office looks through government programs, it finds a number of common problems. Auditor Beth Wood says one of those problems involves contracts.
There's really not a complete database for any of us to see totally what the state of North Carolina has in total contracts. There's a database called Open Book, and it is not complete, and when information is put in there, it's not kept up to date. So there is just no one place that you can go to see all the contracts the state of North Carolina is supposed to be administering.
Wood also highlights a problem of management oversight of government programs.
That is probably as big and as bad as the contracting practices. We've just done a lot of small things, but in every department, every agency, there are departments and divisions and programs and things running, and nobody knows how well or not, how efficiently or not they are running, because there are just no performance metrics. There's nothing out there, and there's no, when I go in and audit something and find something that has not been done well for years, it's too late then. So I don't know what kind of teeth you put into making sure that management is doing their job with the proper policies and procedures and metrics and performance measures to make sure that everything that they are spending taxpayer dollars for is running like it should.
How about government oversight of state and federal grants?
They really don't do a great job of monitoring the dollars that they send out. An audit of the Department of Commerce, we identified that they're sending out at this time $80 million, and this was state monies that they were sending out. They were not properly monitoring the recipients of those dollars and what they were doing with them. So as an aside to that, we said, well, let's take one of their recipients and see what they're doing with the money that was subgranted. So of the $80 million, $60 million went to the Rural Center. And then we found that the Rural Center was sending money to local governments for economic development, and then they weren't making sure that the jobs were being created or the water and sewer lines were being put down that were supposed to spur economic development.
Wood also warns about information technology projects.
We did an audit in 2013 that looked at 84 projects, and on average, they cost more than twice what the agency projected, and they ran more than a year behind schedule. The projects were about $356 million for those that we looked at over budget. And again, it's getting the information into some system where there's an approval process and you get it into the system and it gets approved, but yet nobody's really tracking to see, is this project on schedule and is it on budget?
That's State Auditor Beth Wood highlighting some of the common problems her auditors detect across state government. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Are you wondering where our country is headed? Well, so are two of our most revered presidents. Spend an evening with Thomas Jefferson and John Adams. That's right, Jefferson and Adams visit the Museum of History in Raleigh for a debate on the future of the United States. Hear what Jefferson and Adams think about national security, foreign engagement, and the role of government. While time has passed since they led our country, you'd be amazed the issues and challenges endure. It's a living history event starring two incredible actors as Jefferson and Adams. Monday evening, October 24th, brought to you by the John Locke Foundation. Find details at johnlocke.org. That's John Locke with an E, .org. Or call 866-JLF. INFO. Monday evening, October 24th, at the Museum of History in Raleigh. Tickets are $10 per person, $5 for students. Thomas Jefferson and John Adams live in Raleigh, October 24th. Hope to see you there.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokine. The University of North Carolina system is looking into ways to tie more of its funding to performance measures. UNC is getting some help in that effort from people who've studied so-called performance-based funding. Among them, Matthew Pelish, Senior Director of Strategic Research and Education at the Education Advisory Board. Pelish recently told UNC's Board of Governors that efforts to enact performance-based budgeting across the country have produced mixed results.
Some key points that I think are very important to share. One is the decrease in Pell Grants per FTE that we saw in studies that were done of systems and of institutions that implemented performance-based funding. What does this mean? This means that we have fewer Pell recipients being admitted to performance-based funding campuses. In an effort to somewhat game the system, being the theory here, that we would admit fewer low-income students so that we could make sure that we were meeting the success and the completion goals and not taking the risk that might be associated with Pell recipient students. The other one that we see is the increase in institutional grant aid. This could be better quantified as increase in merit aid to students, meaning we are putting more aid towards high-quality students, tracking those students, trying to get them in the door. Again, using the finances we have to get high-quality students in so that we can make sure we meet the outcomes goals that we have against the performance system. These would be negative impacts that we'd certainly be questioning when you try to break this out. But again, very hard to break out these numbers from the studies that we've seen.
Pelish says research also has shown some positive outcomes from performance-based funding.
We've seen an increase in terms of student services expenditures, meaning we have taken money that have come from the increases in performance funding, or we have just tried to better improve our student outcomes, our student quality, student life on campus because of the impact of outcomes. Question again is where are the funds going in this case from student service increases? Some people say they go towards student success initiatives, advisors, success coaches, academic tutoring, academic counseling, other pieces, but very difficult to break out. There's also been the increase in overall instructional expenditures, meaning we're putting more money into the classroom. We're putting more money into faculty, into teaching and learning within the campus. So it's perceived that those are the positive outcomes.
Pelosh says no one should expect that a move toward performance-based funding would produce major short-term benefits.
No matter what you're doing in terms of outcomes-based funding, it is not a quick fix. The major results that we see show that there's a long amount of time that it takes for there to be success in terms of degree completions or outcomes for these models. If the goal is to change something for next year, performance-based funding and outcomes-based funding is likely not the right move. It is a long-term strategy for the institution or for the system to be thinking about from that perspective. It takes about 7 years from the data set of institutions and states that have implemented performance-based funding for there to actually be a change in terms of the four-year completions of degrees. About a 7-year lag time between the implementation as well as the outcomes of that. The question here is can we look at this as a long-term strategy and not as just the quick fix? I think the greatest quote I heard is that the cement is still wet in a lot of states. We're not quite sure of what the outcomes will be. We're not exactly sure of what the financial outcomes will be. But there is general consensus that we would like to pursue and continue the discussions and find what the right model would be for an individual state.
That's Matthew Pelosh of the Education Advisory Board. His presentation on performance-based funding generated questions from the UNC Board of Governors. Champ Mitchell wanted to know which programs have worked.
Can you pull together for us and give us your estimation based on what you have seen of components of these programs that seem to be keys to success, that seem to have the greatest influence, and perhaps even more importantly, components that have either done no good or had a negative consequence?
The trick is that you have to look at the different weighting of this, that in total, it's hard to say that one individual criteria led to success for the whole model. Linking that up, it's the same thing that we look at from student success in general in the country, that institutions and systems and everybody focused on completion and retention of students will say we implemented 10, 20, 30 different changes on campus. Which one was effective and which one was not, it's hard to make that direct connection.
Board member Joe Knott wanted to be sure that efforts to use performance-based funding in higher education would be different than those put in place in healthcare.
Efficiencies have gone up. Doctors spend less time with patients. Prescriptions are written with less time, but they're is no guarantee that the actual care delivered is better. It seems to me that education is even more of an individual relationship-based enterprise than medicine. And to control an institution by turning on and off the spigot based on arbitrarily set, or maybe not arbitrarily set, but based on criteria set by someone else is no guarantee in the long run that the education delivered will actually be better.
The sort of outcomes of a student in college, university are very directly related to their interaction with faculty members, the experiences they have on campus that can't be quantified always in the same way, that there are those kind of outcomes that are harder to track. Now, what we start to see, though, is when you look at these kind of formulas and you track outcomes and you think about where faculty spend their time and what they're doing and how they focus, there is the specialization of this, the focus on, say, student success administrators. There are those who focus on advising or focus on career outcomes or focus on service learning beyond what faculty do. And we focus faculty time on teaching and learning in the classroom and research and those components that I think are most important to them. So that rather than trying to dilute the faculty time with students being pulled in so many different directions, you almost focus it in a lot of ways on the areas where faculty should be focusing that lead to some of those better outcomes.
Student board member Madeline Finnegan wanted to know whether certain types of campuses tend to benefit or struggle with performance-based funding.
You talked a little bit about the winners and losers, and especially with Tennessee. Mm-hmm. And I guess my question is there a pattern in who you see as winners or who wins? Is it typically maybe a flagship university or a research-focused university?
No, is the short of that. And that's the trick of all this. You'd like to say that, hi, I've seen a very distinct pattern that allows me to say, well, all the state flagship institutions where there is performance-based funding in place have done better than the regional institutions or other serving institutions. Not seen that exactly. I give the one here, and there's been a lot of media stories about Austin Peay State University in Tennessee. Done phenomenal work in terms of student success, phenomenal work in terms of performance analytics for students to understand their degree programs. They are not the state flagship. They're a regional public serving part of the system there that has performed better than almost every other institution in that. So they'd be a bit of the outlier that sets apart from the rest. Their performance, their activities, the things they have done have been able to influence and even give guidance to other parts of the system for those institutional improvements. But I have not seen, and neither have I seen, a study that has shown there is one type of institution that does better than another.
Board member Joan McNeil noted that other states have often adopted performance-based funding, then dropped the idea within a few years.
One thing that has stood out to me was the need for a long-term commitment to actually have any idea whether this is going to be successful or to see success. What are, you couldn't even tell, some states, they're in, they're out, not really sure, they're halfway in. What determines that will for the long-term commitment and for moving towards success with such a model? Is it a political will? Is it the complexity of the explaining it? Is it administrative issues?
I don't know. I wish I, again, could quote a great study or quote a great research piece that says, here's how these types of systems have staying power and have that commitment. Conversationally and anecdotally, I think part of it is the commitment financially to this type of system, that if this is something that's going to be pursued, a large portion of the funds of base allocations are going to be put up as a part of the performance or the outcomes-based funding system. I also think it's certainly a more personal leadership perspective, that this is something that's set out as the strategic initiative or strategic mission of a system or of institutions or of a state, and it's followed through upon and not wavered upon at different times.
You've been listening to highlights from a recent discussion of performance-based funding for the University of North Carolina system. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Are you wondering where our country is headed? Well, so are two of our most revered presidents. Spend an evening with Thomas Jefferson and John Adams. That's right, Jefferson and Adams visit the Museum of History in Raleigh for a debate on the future of the United States. Hear what Jefferson and Adams think about national security, foreign engagement, and the role of government. While time has passed since they led our country, you'd be amazed the issues and challenges endure. It's a living history event starring two incredible actors as Jefferson and Adams. Monday evening, October 24th, brought to you by the John Locke Foundation. Find details at johnlocke.org. That's John Locke with an E, .org. Or call 866-JLF-INFO. Monday evening, October 24th, at the Museum of History in Raleigh. Tickets are $10 per person, $5 for students. Thomas Jefferson and John Adams live in Raleigh, October 24th. Hope to see you there. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. A judge instructs the state of North Carolina to begin compensating landowners who were caught in the clutches of the MAP Act. And a rescue mission struggles with what to do next after being caught up in a local government's decision that will raise the cost of building housing for the poor. Both of these stories reported on by Barry Smith of Carolina Journal. He joins us now with an update. Barry, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Yeah, nice to have you back. You've been doing some excellent reporting, and I really wanted to share a couple of the stories that folks can find at carolinajournal.com under your byline. Let's talk first about the latest in what's known as the MAP Act, which was essentially a state law that kind of bound up people's land and property. But there was a big legal case, and now it looks like the state is going to have to start paying people. Tell us about it.
Right. This state law was enacted actually in the late 80s, so it's not really anything new. What is new is back this summer, the state Supreme Court ruled that if people's property is bound up under the MAP Act, and I'll explain that in just a second what it is, but if it's bound up, the state DOT has to start paying just compensation. It's considered a taking of property for a highway. So what the MAP Act does is if you have property that is located inside a corridor for a highway, then the state has been able to go to your local county or city planners, inspections department, and file that map and say you cannot issue building permits for anything on that property. And so basically that has kept people from using their property how they want to, if they want to add on a room. Renovations, of course, you know, anytime you want to sell your property, you've got to tell your prospective buyer that it's in a highway corridor, and that person's likely not going to want to buy it. What's happened?
A lot of these people were angry about this, right. Understandably so.
Right.
They were essentially unable to do anything with their property. They
right.
sued, and they ended
they
up winning.
And they won. They beat the DOT. What the judge just did, you know, very recently is he's told the DOT, you're going to have to start paying these property owners. I mean, it's actually getting down to the individual property owners who are saying, we want our money. And the judge has actually said, within 90 days, you're going to have to start paying these people who first sued and took their case to the Supreme Court. You're going to have to start making deposits. You're going to have to make offers. Then the folks who are the property owners are going to get about 6 months or so to review the offers, maybe get their own appraisals if they don't think that the DOT was fair. And the whole process will go from there. Eventually, it could end up, you know, like any other case, in a trial to see how much the property is worth.
Interesting that these folks, many of them have waited so long.
Right. A decade or so or more.
This group of people, Barry, are they in a particular area of the state?
They're in several areas of the state. The ones that are affected by this initial court ruling are in Winston-Salem area, and also there are a handful of property owners in Greensboro area. But there are other areas across the state also, in Fayetteville, down along in Pender County. There's some down in Cleveland County. So there, it affects probably 200 to 300 property owners. In fact, in this lawsuit, in the order that was just issued, the first six pages listed the property owners.
Interesting. Now, does the MAP Act, which is the law that
right.
was in question here, is it still active? Can North Carolina still impose this on people?
Well, the legislature, after the Supreme Court made its ruling, the legislature this summer basically suspended the MAP Act for a year. They're not going to impose that on any other property owners other than ones that have already had their property tied up. And basically, they're looking to study the issue about over the next year and come back sometime next year for the General Assembly. People basically tell me, for all intents and purposes, the MAP Act is dead as far as future, as far as the future is concerned.
Pretty interesting. So you can read that story, the update on what's happening with the compensation process for these property owners at CarolinaJournal.com. We're talking with Barry Smith. He's the reporter on the story. Barry, you also have been reporting on something going on in Durham
right.
County. This involves the Durham Rescue Mission, which is a wonderful organization, mm-hmm. does great work to help people who are homeless or living on the margins, help them get back on their feet. But they have found themselves in the political crosshairs, so to speak, of a local city council that has tried to essentially tell them, well, we're going to do something special in this area of Durham, and it's going to mean that if you want to build housing for the poor, it's going to cost a lot
right.
more money.
Right. The Durham Rescue Mission, a lot of their property in Durham has been included in a new historic district. So historic districts are when you build a house or when you renovate a house or do anything, they actually go through another layer of bureaucracy. Usually, if you want to do something, you go to the town hall, city hall, you get your permit. If it's within the zoning code, you go build it. If it's not within the zoning code, you go and ask and beg and plead for the planning board to change the zoning or to give you a variance. Well, in addition to all that, which they'll still have to do, they'll have to go through a historic district, get approval from the historic district. And so historic district codes, everything's kind of got to match. It's got to fit in. So they say, the Durham Rescue Mission folks say, it's going to increase the cost of building a house, maybe from, maybe not double it, but significantly increase it. From $80 or $90 a square foot to maybe $120, $130 a square foot. Now, keep in mind, this is an organization that gets no money from the government. Every dollar it gets comes from volunteers, voluntary contributions, and they want to stretch the volunteer dollars, you know, as much as they can.
So let me make sure I understand this. It's worked out now that if they want to build something, mm-hmm. housing for the poor, mm-hmm. on land that they own, mm-hmm. not only will they have to incur the normal costs
right.
in order to do that, but because of these special rules and regulations mm-hmm. that are now in place as a, quote, historic district,
right.
they're going to have to make sure that materials
fit in
of a certain grade,
higher standards, basically.
Is this this gentrification thing we keep hearing about?
That's part of it. It is part of it. The residents are hoping that to maintain their neighborhood. The people who live around them are hoping to maintain their neighborhood. And, of course, you know, there are different studies that say that these type of districts have higher property values, which would be harder for the poor. But, you know, some say, well, they actually stabilize the values also. But in any event, it will cost the rescue mission more money. They wanted to build a community center there. That, they say, is out now. And they have about 15 vacant lots that are in the district. And they're saying, well, we've got to go back to the drawing board. We're used to helping the poor people out. We're not used to historic districts. So they're going to have to go back to the drawing board and figure out how they're going to do it.
Barry, did the Durham City Council realize what the consequences would be for the Durham Rescue Mission and the poor in that area?
They knew what was going on. The vote was actually 4-3, so it was a very close vote. And there was a lot of, you know, over an hour's worth of public hearings, people talking about it.
What's next for the rescue mission?
Well, they say they really don't know. They're looking for an architect who knows how to build in historic districts to come and advise them. And I'm sure that if you know something about it, they'd love your advice.
We've been talking with Barry Smith. He's a reporter with Carolina Journal. Barry, thank you.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for Carolina Journal Radio this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Gokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll come back again next week for more Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.